Hello, you are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Welcome to Prof Talk. I'm your host, Farha Khan. A Canadian biologist was named as one of 10 people who mattered last year by the science journal Nature. This biologist is a UBC zoology professor, Rosie Redfield. Rosie Redfield's research sits at the interface of bacterial molecular genetics and microbial evolution, and most notable are her ideas on natural competence and quorum sensing in bacteria. Not very long ago, she was at the center of a media frenzy for her criticism of an article published in the journal Science, where some researchers asserted that bacteria found in Lake Mono in California were able to substitute arsenate for phosphate in their nucleic acids and proteins. Redfield argued in a detailed post on her blog, RRR Research, that there was no convincing evidence that arsenic had been incorporated into the DNA. This criticism drew worldwide attention and propelled into the public's awareness a new understanding of how the blogosphere has changed the methodology of scientific evaluation and communication. Rosie Redfield is my guest today here in studio in CITR, and she joins me now. Thank you, Rosie, for coming in today.
Glad to be here.
So tell us about the discovery of NASA in late 2010 that you reacted to.
Well, it was a sort of unexpected big splash by NASA. They put out first a teaser of a press release that they were going to have a press conference with a breakthrough with implications for extrastellar life. And everybody got very excited and rushed into this. Everybody went to this press conference. It was televised. And they had a panel of researchers who reported that they had found in bacteria growing in the mud at the bottom of California's Mono Lake that these bacteria could grow using arsenic instead of phosphorus. Phosphorus is one of the essential building blocks of life. It's the backbone of our DNA and our RNA. And these researchers claimed that because these bacteria grew in an environment where there was a lot of arsenic, they had evolved the ability to use arsenic instead of phosphorus in the backbone of their DNA and their RNA.
And so, what did you say
first,
to that?
The media went nuts, and it was on CNN, it was in newspapers, headlines, you know, alien life form, rewrite the textbooks. It was a big splash. And that splash lasted about 2 or 3 days. The research paper had been published in Science. And so people whose universities had a subscription to Science were able to read the article. And it took a couple of days before researchers read the article and said, now, hang on. And I was the first to say, hang on, publicly, because I have a research blog on which I mostly write about my own laboratory's experiments. But in this case, I was really so disgusted with the paper that I wrote a long, detailed critique of the science of the paper on my blog, including such harsh statements as if a grad student presented this work at their committee meeting, I'd send them back to the bench to do more cleanup and controls. And I even speculated about the author's motives, whether they'd been kind of swept along by NASA's enthusiasm for finding life in space, and whether the journal had been swept along by the glory of having such a high-impact paper. I didn't really expect anybody to read what I'd written because nobody reads my blog, really. That's day-to-day research in my laboratory is not that exciting. But it got picked up, and suddenly it went viral. And over the course of the next week, I had 100,000 hits on this obscure little blog. And if these hits had been people saying, no, you got it all wrong. Really, this paper's pretty good. It's really important. I would have been sort of chastised. But in fact, the comments all came, many of the comments came from scientists whose opinions I respect, saying, you got that one right. We all agree on this. And so there was a second lower scale media frenzy about the problems with the paper, quoting a number of scientists, experts in the field, saying, no, really, we don't believe a word of it. One of the problems, of course, is that this we don't believe a word of it media coverage was much smaller than the original coverage. So I think 90% at least of the people who remember anything about this will remember that, oh, arsenic in DNA, rewrite the textbooks, and not, oh, science is wrong. And even of the ones who will remember, oh, science was wrong, will be thinking, oh, science was wrong again. You can't trust those scientists. Whereas the real scientific view of this is, well, yes, this is how science is supposed to work. Mm-hmm. Ideas get published. If they're wrong, people notice. They get corrected.
So how did you and over, you know, a dozen of other scientists around the world go about proving that, you know, NASA's research couldn't be accurate?
Well, I eventually did some experiments, but I need to first explain that scientifically there really wasn't any need to do any more experiments because of what's called the prior likelihood that this result could be right. The things we already knew about how arsenic behaves chemically told us that you couldn't build DNA backbones out of arsenic because even though the shape of arsenic and the kinds of bonds it forms, the geometry of the bonds, is very like that of phosphorus, the bonds are much less stable. And that means that even if you could start to make a DNA backbone out of arsenic, it would fall apart right away, within a fraction of a second, the backbone would break. This is absolutely the kiss of death for DNA because the whole reason we evolved to put our genetic information into DNA is that it's a very stable molecule. A molecule of DNA in pure water will keep for hundreds of thousands of years if you keep nasty stuff like oxygen away from it, whereas arsenic DNA would fall apart immediately. This was chemistry this wasn't speculative chemistry. This is stuff the chemists were really confident about. So that was one reason to think this result couldn't be right before we even saw the data. Another reason was the biochemistry and evolution of how we replicate our DNA. That when we replicate our DNA, the enzymes that do it are very, very careful. They double check every base that they put in, just like when you're writing a term paper, you check your typing. But this is much more important. And so the enzymes, DNA polymerases and others that make and repair DNA, are far more careful than you or your word processor. They make mistakes maybe one time in 100 million. And the reason they are able to be so careful is that they fit very tightly onto the DNA and they can feel if something's not quite right, it'll be a little bulge or a dent. Arsenic, by its very nature, is bigger than phosphorus. If you made DNA out of arsenic, suddenly none of the enzymes would fit anymore. And either the enzymes would say, I can't replicate this, this is junk, it's the wrong shape. Or they would have to evolve to be sort of sloppy, and the error rate would just be disastrous. So that was another reason to think, no, this couldn't be right. On top of that, the quality of the researchers' data was really, it was really bad grad student level work. This is like beginning grad students before they become polished experimenters. There was the raw materials the cells were growing on, which were supposed to not have any phosphorus in them, so the cells would have to have been using arsenic. In fact, there was phosphorus in the medium. The researchers hadn't used the expensive analytical-grade chemicals that would be relatively free of contaminants, but had instead just used ordinary, the cheap stuff, chemicals that, and phosphorus is a very common contaminant. They'd also been really sloppy in purifying the DNA that they analyzed to show there was arsenic in it. They didn't wash their DNA. And there's all researchers, all molecular biology researchers purify DNA using kits, great little kits. They're little columns that you spin in a tiny centrifuge. They cost $2. It takes 10 minutes to do the purification. And for some reason, the researchers didn't include these purification steps. So there was every reason to suspect that the arsenic that they found in their DNA had actually been carried over from the arsenic that was in the medium they grew the cells in. So combining all of the experimental problems with the prior reasons to think this result was impossible meant that the probability that it could be true was so low that scientifically, there was no justification for putting in the work to demonstrate that the result was false. As one commenter on a blog pointed out, no granting agency would ever give you the money to do the work to show this experiment was wrong. So why did I go do the work to show this experiment was wrong then? Well, it's mostly science theater. I think there was a consensus, especially among the science journalists, who I have to say, the people most interested in this whole ongoing story have been the science journalists. They really see the implications of new forms of communication, social media, for science as being enormously important. And the science journalists were all saying, oh, you know, somebody should do the experiment. And the commenters on blogs, especially the non-scientists, were saying, oh, but nobody's done the experiment. And I thought, well, maybe I should try it. I mean, the basic thing that I thought the researchers had, although their inputs were dirty, they'd used very high-tech assay methods on their dirty DNA. And I thought, well, I can at least grow the cells in clean medium and clean up the DNA, and I could probably find somebody to do the one high-tech assay that needs to be done. So maybe I should try this. But the real reason I decided to do it actually had nothing to do with the science. It had to do with the how science should be done. So I have a research blog, and I do something very, very unusual there, which is I write about the research in my lab before it gets published. I don't just say, oh, look, we published a paper and here's why it's important. I write, oh, okay, today I'm going to try and do this experiment. And then later I write, oh, my God, the incubator threw a fit and my experiment was a total failure. Check again tomorrow. So it's a very... I want people to be able to see openly how science is done, not just to see the results in the newspaper or in the scientific journals. But as I said, nobody's really been very interested in my blog about my research. And this arsenic story was a chance to do research in the open, writing about it openly on my blog, about something that people actually cared about. And so I thought, well, maybe I will. So I wrote a blog post and I said, well, if I did it, this is what I would do and this is what I would do. And by the way, does anybody out there know how to do this high-tech mass spectrometry analysis that we'd need to do? And I got an email back from researchers at Princeton saying, oh yeah, we could do this. We'll work with you. And so I emailed them back and said, will you do this openly? I'm going to write about every step on my blog. Are you okay with this? And they said, oh, sure. So that's what we did.
It's been a fascinating story of open science. And do you think that what you're doing is catching on in the other sort of scientific world, or other people trying to do the same thing?
People are noticing. Again, the science journalists deserve a lot of credit. The thing with Nature and the 10 people who made a difference last year was partly a recognition of the arsenic work, but it was largely a recognition of doing science openly. So it certainly brought attention. Some people were doing science openly anyway. Whether what I'm doing is actually changed what scientists do, well, it's hard to tell. Scientists are very conservative, and junior scientists are especially cautious. They've been warned, oh, no, when you go to the conference, you know, don't talk about this research. Somebody might steal your ideas. And they're very worried about this. And it's going to, I think, take a long time for people to realize that they have more to gain by sharing their ideas than to lose. That for every person who would steal your ideas, there might be 5 people out there who will join you and help you to advance your ideas. But it's taking time for that to catch on.
Is that something you're communicating with your grad students and some of the younger scientists?
Well, I try. And I keep sort of reassuring people that you can be open. Nothing bad is going to happen. Nobody's going to steal your ideas. And I think it will gradually catch on. Certainly science publication is becoming more and more open. Scientists are working very hard to find ways to make sure that when they write a research paper, that anybody can read it. It's not locked away in a scientific journal that you have to have an expensive subscription to, or you have to belong to a university to be able to read this article. We're trying to make all our articles open access so anybody can read them. And then for that idea of openness to extend to making the research open before it's published, it's happening, but it's slow.
So tell us what has happened since then. Before we began talking, you were explaining some of the progress of what you did on your blog openly,
right,
and now what you've submitted back to the journal.
So Science. The blog, doing the arsenic experiments openly on my blog, provided really an excellent example of what real scientists do most of the time. The truth is, most scientists spend most of their time trying to figure out why their experiments won't work. That's not trying to figure out why their experiments gave the wrong answer or the answer they didn't want. It's, this experiment didn't work. So I spent, the first month, once I'd gotten the bacteria, the researchers made the strain of bacteria available to anybody who wanted it, as they were obliged to do. But once I got the bacteria, I spent a month just trying to figure out how to get them to grow. They wouldn't grow on the medium that was specified by the researchers. And it took a month of troubleshooting on my blog, cursing, oh no, they won't grow. They still won't grow. Wait, these cells don't look healthy at all. Before I finally figured out that there was a missing ingredient, that I had to add a source of nitrogen in the form of amino acids, and then the cells grew great. So that was problem number one solved, and then I could measure how the cells' growth depended on how much phosphorus they had. That worked fine. And then I thought, time to start working with arsenic. And then there was a long series of posts on my blog cursing UBC's chemical safety office, who I had prudently contacted them saying, arsenic, geez, I've never worked with arsenic. What do I need to do? Safety precautions. And UBC's chemical safety office was useless. they seem to be more concerned with greening the campus and finding, you know, safe ways for us to dispose of our chemicals without harming the environment. But it was really hard to get any information about how to avoid harming myself with my chemicals. But luckily, I had a colleague in chemical engineering who'd worked with arsenic, and she gave me useful advice instead. So I figured out how to work with arsenic, added the arsenic to the bacteria. I knew from the research paper how much they should be able to grow. And, oh, one flask grew and one didn't. Try it again tomorrow. Oh, this time everybody grew. Try it again. Oh, nobody grew. Oh, now some of them grew, some of them didn't grow. So there was another month of demonstrating, trying to figure out why my experiments won't work, trying to figure out how come growth in arsenic was unpredictable. And the sad truth is I still haven't solved that problem. But I did get it predictable enough that I could grow the bacteria in arsenic, purify DNA from them, wash it really clean, and send it to the guys at Princeton, where a graduate student analyzed it, cleaned it up some more. Turned out my careful washing hadn't completely gotten rid of the arsenic. And then he put it through his mass spectrometry system looking for arsenic in the DNA. And he reported back that, nope, there's no arsenic. There's no more arsenic in the DNA than there is in the purified water that we're using as a control. It's not quite the same. There isn't that there's absolutely no arsenic. There's arsenic everywhere at low levels. It's just a part of the natural environment, but no more than in the water. So, quick, write the paper. Quick. Oh, maybe we better replicate this experiment first. So I grew more cells, made more DNA, sent him more DNA. He analyzed it again. And then we wrote the paper and submitted it to Science, saying no arsenic in DNA of arsenic-grown GFAJ1 cells. That's the name of the cells. Oh, I should tell you, this is one of those jokes gone bad. The name of the bacteria is GFAJ-1, which sounds like just some random initials, but is actually a joke when the researchers who did the work were studying this. They had to give a name to their bacteria that they isolated. And they called it GFAJ, standing for Give Felisa a Job. Felisa Wolf-Simon is the researcher who took primary responsibility for the work. This was really her postdoctoral research project. And if the research had held up, that would have just been a funny joke and she would have a really good job. And instead, things went sour, and it's now kind of embarrassing. But that's still the name of the bacteria. But there's no arsenic in their DNA. So we submitted the paper to Science, the same high-prestige journal that had published the original report. And then we waited and we waited and we waited. And then a couple of weeks ago, what happens when you submit a journal to a paper, when you submit a paper to a journal, is that the editors send it out to other scientists to critique it. And then once the journal editors have received the critiques, then they send you a copy of the critiques along with their decision about whether they'll publish the article or not. Usually their decision is either, no, we don't think so, or, well, if you fix up all these problems, we'll publish it. And they send you anonymously the criticisms. So we got criticisms from, first they'd gotten two reviewers' comments, and then the editor told us, oh, well, we needed another opinion. So they got a third reviewer. Some of you may know that the third reviewer is the bane of the existence of every scientific paper. There's one of those YouTube Hitler parody videos about Hitler getting his paper back, and the third reviewer hates it. Anyway, but we were okay. The third reviewer liked it too. And so our paper has been provisionally accepted by Science, which is a very nice, high-prestige journal. But we do have to polish some things up, and we have one more experiment to do. So right now I'm waiting for the graduate student at Princeton to do the final analysis of how much phosphate was in the medium that I made, because that fits into the arithmetic of how the cells would grow. And then once we have that number, then we just make a few corrections and send it back, and we would hope the paper would appear maybe within a few weeks.
That's great. Now, can you tell us the link to your blog? So for those that are listening, we can follow up on all this.
Right. So you can follow up on it's called the Arsenic Life Saga. That was its Twitter hashtag. And, of course, all of the other exciting research that's going on in my lab.
That's right, which we didn't have time for today.
Answering such questions as, do bacteria have sex? And do they really talk to each other? On my blog, whose name is RR Research, RR for Rosie Redfield Research, so three R's, RR Research, at fieldofscience.com, or maybe it's .org.
Yeah.
Anyway, RR Research. If you Google RR Research, that's me.
You'll get it. Thank you, Rosie. It's been so much fun to have you, and it's been great to follow up on all of these things. And I hope that when the article does come out in Science, it does get some press. And
I hope so, too.
Yeah. And those
it's been
out
fun.
There. Yeah. Thanks again. I've just been speaking with Dr. Rosie Redfield. She's a professor in the zoology department at UBC. Rosie Redfield was listed as one of the top 10 science newsmakers of 2011 by the journal Nature. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. Next week, I will speak with Dr. Julio Montaner from the UBC Faculty of Medicine. Dr. Montaner is a world authority in AIDS research. If you'd like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, please visit proftalk.ubc.ca or email us at prof.talk@ubc.ca. I'm your host, Farha Khan. Thank you for listening today.
Hey! Look at Ramones, this one's called Rock Away, baby! The sun is out and I'm awesome. It's time for the fun to beat. We get into rhymes to ride the wave beats. I'm on the roof, I don't sat in the playground, I'm on the roof. First rat is too slow. A blast that's the slow on the radio. Ride, ride, ride the wave beats. Ride, ride, ride the wave beats. Ride, ride, ride the wave beats. We get into rhymes to ride the wave beats. Ride, ride, ride the wave beats. Rock, rock, rock the wave beats. Rock, rock, rock the wave beats. We get into rhymes to rock the wave beats. Not hold up for to leave. We get into rhymes to rock the wave beats. It's not hold up for to freeze. Freaking into rides and ride the wave beats. Do not fit up on my bubble gum. Sun is out, I won't serve. If I hold up on the beach. Freaking into rides and ride the wave beats. I'm on the roof, out on the street. Down in the playground, I'm going to.